Now, the question that we have to consider at this point, bringing us to part three of our lecture, is how does alienated awareness arise? How do we come, that is to say, not to experience ourselves? Now, we may say that this is due to some extent to the nature of the very times in which we live, especially here in the West. We're often told that we're living in an age of transition, and this is very true. Sometimes we don't realize how abrupt, even violent, how important also, how potentially valuable the transition is. Many of the old values are breaking up. People are no longer quite so sure what is right and what is wrong. Not quite so sure what they ought to do or not to. Not quite so sure how they ought to live, in what way they ought to live. Not sure what role to adopt, what part to play. And all this means that we are no longer sure who or what we are. Our sense of identity is weakened, and on this account, there's a widespread feeling of anxiety. Now, I don't want to attach too much importance to this factor of the times in which we live. I want to look more closely at some of the more immediate factors. I've spoken of three levels of awareness of self, that is to say, awareness of body, of feelings and emotions, and of thoughts. So, in the same way, we can speak of three levels of experience of self, and even three levels of alienated awareness, or three levels of non-experience of self. First of all, non-experience of the body. There are several reasons for this. One of the most important is the refusal actually to experience, or to allow ourselves to experience, bodily sensations, especially, we may say, sensations connected with sex. And such refusal is very often connected with wrong early training. In this way, one finds, for instance, that people are taught, or at least they're brought up with the idea, with the vague feeling, that the body is somehow shameful. At least it's not so noble as the mind, or so respectable as the mind. And in the same way, one is inculcated very often with the feeling, or with the idea, that sexual feelings are sinful. And all these sort of ideas, all these sort of feelings, we may say, are legacies, attitudes left over from Christianity. And though in many ways we might have outgrown Christianity, outgrown at least Christian dogma and ecclesiastical supervision, these sort of attitudes are very, very widespread and still do quite a lot of harm. And we may say that it's one of the great merits of the work of Wilhelm Reich that he's gone into this whole question, this whole subject, so very thoroughly, and has shown quite clearly how the inhibition very early in life, even in infancy, of pleasurable bodily sensations could lead ultimately to a crippling negation on the part of the adult person of his or her whole life force. So this is non-experience of the body, and to some extent how it's come about. Then non-experience of feelings and emotions. This also comes about in various ways. We're told, for instance, or we've been brought up to believe, that certain emotions are wrong, especially negative emotions, and should not be indulged in. For instance, we're taught that anger is wrong. It's wrong to get angry. So, having been taught in this way, we feel guilty if we happen to get angry or to become angry for any reason. So, on this account, it sometimes happens that even when we are angry, we try to pretend that we are not angry. We refuse to recognize that we are angry. In other words, we repress the feeling, we refuse to experience it, and it goes underground. Then again, what happens is we experience an emotion, but we are told by somebody, someone in an authoritative position, that we do not in fact experience that emotion. For instance, mother tells the small boy that he is not afraid of the dark. Because, she says, brave little boys are never afraid of the dark. So we want to be considered a brave little boy, of course. So we repress, we push, or we try to push out of sight our fear of the dark. In other words, we cease to experience the fear, at least cease to experience it consciously. It just gets repressed. And it may, of course, come out in dreams. We may have terrible nightmares. Or perhaps it happens that we just don't like our little sister. This is a very common family situation. But we are told by mother or by father that of course we like her because she's our little sister. So we don't know where we stand, as it were. We experience a feeling, but we're told we don't experience it. Not even that we ought not to, but that we don't, that we can't. It's impossible. Like when the little boy sometimes blurts out, well, I'd like to kill daddy. But mother says, well, of course you don't. No one would ever want to kill daddy. That's psychologically impossible. You don't. So it's repressed. We cease to experience it. Or another common example, the little boy or the little girl doesn't like brown bread. But mother says, well, of course you like it because it's good for you. So once again, confusion and repression. And in this way, the child does become very, very confused indeed. In this and other ways, the child becomes alienated from his or her own feelings. And the effects of this may continue throughout life. Not only continue, but be powerfully reinforced from other sources. Because the same type of conditioning still goes on. When we're a bit older, maybe when we're adolescent, we discover we dislike going to parties. But we convince ourselves, perhaps, that we do like going, because everybody likes going. So, of course, we do too. Or, we may say, on another level, we discover that we're not in the least moved by the work of a certain famous artist. We may privately think it's just deplorable, it just leaves us cold. But we find that all our most intelligent friends are very much moved by the work of that great artist. In fact, they're highly excited about it. So we have to be highly excited too. Now, we need not multiply examples. The end result is that we become alienated to a greater or a lesser degree from our own feelings and our own emotions. Now, non-experience of thoughts. Here, it's not so much that we fail to experience our thoughts, it's more like that we fail to have any thoughts at all. This is because, we may say, nowadays, so many agencies are telling us what to think, telling us, in fact, what we think. Parents are telling us what to think. Teachers are telling us what to think. This isn't just a question of feeding us with information, with facts. That's all right. That's quite a different thing. But it's value judgments that are also imparted, that this is right and that is wrong and this is good and this is bad and so on. And then there are the various media. There are the newspapers, radio, television. They're also giving us information, yes, very slanted, very selective information, and also making up our minds for us about this, that and the other in a way of which practically all the time we're not really conscious at all. So having seen this, having made this little survey, we can begin to see what sort of state most of us are in, at least to some extent. We're in a state of alienation from ourselves. alienation from our own physical bodies, from our feelings, from our emotions, and from our thoughts. We don't experience ourselves. And this is something that we really have to recognize and really have to accept and really come to terms with, that we don't experience ourselves. Once again, we can think in terms of the iceberg. Just the tip protrudes above the surface of the waves. There's a whole mass of the iceberg below. So the tip is visible. The greater part of the iceberg is not visible. So it's just like that with our experience of ourselves. Our self is relatively extensive. Just like the iceberg continuing underneath the water. But that part of the self, of our self, which we experience, which we allow ourselves to experience, that we are allowed to experience, is relatively small. In some cases, it's even infinitesimal.